special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Larissa Biggers from North Carolina Reading Service. I'll be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated with and with an introduction and notes by Robin Boos. I'm going to begin with the chronology. In 1802, Alexandre Dumas was born in Villers-Cotterêts, and forgive my French pronunciation, but Villers-Cotterêts, the third child of Thomas Alexandre Dumas. His father, himself the illegitimate son of a marquis and a slave girl of San Domingo, Marie Cécette Dumas, had a remarkable career as a general in the Republican and then Napoleonic Army. 1806. General Dumas dies. Alexandra and his mother, Elizabeth Laboureux, are left virtually penniless. In 1822, Dumas takes a post as a clerk, then in 1923 is granted a cincture on the staff of the Duke of Orléans. He meets the actor Talma and starts to mix in artistic and literary circles, writing sketches for the popular theater. 1824, Dumas's son Alexandre, future author of La Dame aux Camélias, is born as a result of an affair with a seamstress, Catherine Labbé. 1829, Dumas's historical drama Henri III et sa cour is produced at the Comédie Française. It is an immediate success, marking Dumas out as a leading figure in the Romantic movement. 1830, Victor Hugo's drama, Hermione, becomes the focus of the struggle between the Romantics and the traditionalists in literature. In July, the Bourbon monarchy is overthrown and replaced by a new regime under the Orleanist King Louis Philippe. Dumas actively supports the insurrection. 1831, Dumas's melodrama, Antony, with his archetypal romantic hero, triumphs at the Théâtre de la Porte Saint-Martin. 1832, Dumas makes a journey to Switzerland, which will form the basis of his first travel book, published the following year. 1835, Dumas travels to Naples with Ida Ferrier, whom he will later marry, has a passionate affair in Naples with Caroline Unger, and falls in love with Italy and the Mediterranean. 1836, triumph of Dumas's play, Keen, based on the personality of the English actor whom Dumas has seen performing in Shakespeare in 1828. 1839, Mademoiselle Belle-Île, Dumas's greatest success in the theater. 1840, Dumas marries Ida Ferrier. He travels down the Rhine with Gérard de Nerval, and they collaborate on the drama Leo Burckhardt. Nerval introduces Dumas to Auguste Macquet, who will become his collaborator on many of his subsequent works. 1841, spends a year in Florence. 1844, the year of Dumas's two great novels, The Three Musketeers, starts to appear in serial form in March, and the first episodes of The Count of Monte Cristo follow in August. Dumas starts to build his Chateau de Monte Cristo at Saint-Germain-en-Laye. He separates from Ida Ferrier. 1845, 20 years after, the sequel to The Three Musketeers appears at the beginning of the year. In February, Dumas wins a libel action against the author of a book accusing him of plagiarism, publishes La Reine Margot. 1846, Dumas travels to Spain and North Africa, publishes La Dame de Montsoreau, Les Deux Dians, and Joseph Balsamo. 1847, Dumas's theater, the Théâtre Historique, opens. It will show several adaptions of his novels, including The Three Musketeers and La Reine Margot, serialization of The Vicomte de Bragelonne, the final episode of The Three Musketeers. 1848, a revolution in February deposes Louis-Philippe and brings in the Second Republic. Dumas stands unsuccessfully for Parliament and supports Louis Napoleon, nephew of Napoleon I, who becomes President of the Republic. 1849, Dumas publishes The Queen's Necklace. 1850, Dumas is declared bankrupt and has to sell the Chateau de Monte Cristo and the Théâtre Historique, publishes The Black Tulip. 1851, in December, Louis Napoleon seizes power in a coup d'état, effectively abolishing the Republic. A year later, the Second Empire will be proclaimed. Victor Hugo goes into exile in Belgium, where Dumas, partly to escape his creditors, joins him. 1852, publishes his memoirs. 1853, in November, returns to Paris and founds a newspaper, Les Mousquetaires, publishes Ange Pitou. 1858, founds the literary weekly Le Monte Cristo, sets out on a 9-month journey to Russia. 1860, meets Garibaldi and actively supports the Italian struggle against Austria. Founds L'Indépendant, a periodical in Italian and French. Garibaldi is godfather to Dumas's daughter by Émile Cordier. 1861 until 1870, Dumas continues to travel throughout Europe and to write, though his output is somewhat reduced. Nonetheless, in the final decade of his life, he published some 6 plays, 13 novels, several shorter fictions, a historical work on the Bourbons in Naples, and a good deal of journalism. He has a last love affair with an American, Ada Menken, and indulges his lifelong passions for drama, travel, and cookery. 1870, Alexandre Dumas dies on 5 December in Dieppe. Introduction. A children's novel, a Russian filmmaker remarked when I told her that I was translating The Count of Monte Cristo. The comment was not intended to be disparaging, merely descriptive, and many people in different cultures would tend to agree with the categorization. Most will derive their idea of the novel not from having read it, but because of a kind of abstract of the storyline exist as part of the common culture. Innocent man imprisoned, exits as part of the common culture, innocent man in prison, meets fellow prisoner, who directs him to a buried fortune, escapes and plots revenge. It has been adapted for film, television, and the theater, as well as being translated, abridged, and imitated in print. It has supplied material for cartoons and comedy. The Irish comedian Dave Allen used to do a series of sketches around the theme of a young man, Dantes, breaking through a dungeon wall and encountering an old bearded prisoner, Abbé Faria. Some events in the story are so well known that they exist apart from the novel, like Robinson Crusoe's discovery of Man Friday's footprints, or incidents and characters from Treasure Island and Frankenstein. The Count of Monte Cristo is one of the great popular novels of the time. Like other popular novels, it has suffered the fate of being treated as not fully adult fiction. Like children's fiction, it seems to inhabit a realm outside its creator's biography and the period when it was written. On the other hand, there are not many children's books, even in our own time, that involve a female serial prisoner, 2 cases of infanticide, a stabbing and 3 suicides, an extended scene of torture and execution, drug-induced sexual fantasies, illegitimacy, transvestism, and lesbianism, a display of the author's classical learning and his knowledge of modern European history, the customs and diets of Italians, the effect of hashish, and so on. The length would, in any case, immediately disqualify it from inclusion in any modern series of books for children. Most important of all, perhaps, is the fact that the author himself never thought of this as a children's novel. Yet, already, in the earliest translations into English, with their omission or subtle alteration of material that might be considered indelicate by Victorian readers, and some passages, for example, references to classical literature that might be thought to hold up the story, one can see the start of a process of transformation from novel to genre novel, which means, ultimately, almost any kind of genre novel: adventure, romance, thriller, and, if you like, children's novel. This is the usual fate of books that fail to meet the critics. Pardon me. This is the usual fate of books that fail to meet the criteria for serious literary fiction. Dumas himself must bear some of the responsibility. During his most productive decade, from 1841 to 1850, he wrote 41 novels, 23 plays, 7 historical works, and half a dozen travel books. The 19th century was an age of mass production, which is precisely why art felt the need to distinguish himself by its individuality and craftsmanship. Alexandre Dumas and Company, a novel factory, was a contemptuous title given to one critical pamphlet published at the same time as this novel in 1845. Moreover, it was well known that Dumas wrote for money, and so wrote for money at so much a line, and that he used at least one collaborator, Auguste Maquet, who would make chapter outlines for him and do research. There was a vast difference between this industrial labor and the monastic devotion to the cause that kept Gustave Flaubert at his desk for 7 hours a day as he rewrote and rewrote Madame Bovary, 1857. In the history of the novel, Dumas and Flaubert stand near the head of divergent streams. Alexandre Dumas was born 24 July 1802, since the Republican calendar was still in force on the 5th Thermidor, year X, or year Roman numeral 10, in the little town of Villers-Cotterêts near Soissons. His father was a general in the Revolutionary armies, himself the illegitimate son of a marquise, Antoine Alexandre Davy de la Perrée, and a black slave from the island of Santo Domingo, Marie Dumas. In 1806, General Dumas died, leaving the family virtually without resources. The child had little education, however, enough to allow him to read Robinson Crusoe and the Arabian Nights and to cultivate his handwriting. In 1923, thanks to the second of these, he found employment in Paris, copying documents for Louis-Philippe, Duke of Orléans. The 1820s were a marvelous time for an aspiring young writer in Paris. The two rival literary ideologies of classicism and romanticism were engaged in a mock heroic combat for the soul of French literature. Classicism stood for several universal themes: refinement, purity of language, clear division of literary genres, and, despite its debt to the literature of the classical world, the peculiarly French ethos of the dramaticist Racine. Romanticism meant energy, modern subject matter, mixing genres, and openness to foreign influences, particularly that of Shakespeare, the romantic dramatist par excellence. It was in the theater that the confrontation would chiefly take place. Racine had based his plays on stories from classical Greece or on biblical history, both of which offered universal events and characters. Shakespeare, like the German playwright Schiller, had dealt with subjects from modern history, which were national and particular rather than universal. In France especially, the period that followed the great upheavals of the Revolution, the Empire, and the Restoration was one which had an urgent need to make sense of the past. Shakespeare's history plays, and still more the historical novels of Walter Scott, were models of how this could be done, drawing on the imagination as well as on scholarship. In 1928, Dumas, who had already tried his hand at a couple of plays and some short stories, submitted a historical drama to the Comédie Française entitled Henri III et sa Cour. It was a typically romantic work, ignoring the unities of time, place, and action, and written in prose rather than in the conventional medium of verse. It underwent the usual ritual of a public reading, and at its first night on 10 February 1829, scored a triumphant success and was warmly applauded by the author's employer, Louis-Philippe. In the following year, Louis-Philippe became king after a liberal revolution that was supposed to bring a constitutional monarchy. Dumas welcomed it. So did the former ultra-monarchist Victor Hugo. During the next 20 years, Dumas was, with Hugo and Alfred de Vigny, the leading dramatist of the new movement, and of the three, easily the most prolific. Perhaps so too much so. Overnight, after the first performance of Christine in 1830, while Dumas was asleep, Hugo and Vinet rewrote the play, reducing it to a more manageable size. Despite this, Dumas's play Antony, 1831, was an essential work of the Romantic period, as representative as Hugo's Ernani, or Vigny's Chateaubriand, and the more successful with its audience than either. But the theater is the very opposite of a monastic cell or an ivory tower. Collaborative is not only the norm, but inevitable. Feedback from the public is instantaneous. Work has to be produced to satisfy demand, and there is an immediate relationship between the author's output and what comes in through the box office. In the theater, Dumas learned the rudiments of literary production. On one occasion, Charles-Jean Arel, director of the Odeon Theater, is supposed to have locked Dumas into a room away from his mistress for a week until he had completed the manuscript of Napoleon, 1831. The huge growth in the periodical press during the 1820s saw the invention of the feuilleton, not in the sense of a regular column by one writer, but of a novel published in installments. Dumas claimed to have invented the Roman feuilleton with the Comtesse de Salisbury, published in La Presse in 1836. By the early 1840s, he was writing more novels than plays, mainly, but by no means exclusively, historical fiction, which, as I have already mentioned, was one of the most popular genres. It was also taken seriously as a means of exploring the past. He did, incidentally, write a book for children at this time, Le Captain d'Ampile, in 1839. Travel, to which he was addicted, helped to stave off boredom, providing the material for travel books, while translation filled in the remaining gaps of the working day. Like Balzac, he was a man of huge appetite. Food, sex, work, sleep, pleasure, leisure, movement, excitement. In Italy, he found love, opera, color, and the Mediterranean. He visited Naples and Palermo in 1835, stayed for a year in Florence in 1841, and returned in 1843 for a visit that included Sicily. The following year saw the publication of his first great historical novel, The Trois Mousquetaires, Three Musketeers. And on 28 August 1844, Le Journal de Débat began publication of The Count of Monte Cristo. It was an immediate success, translated, adapted, pirated, in short, a popular novel. It was also very clearly a work of its time. The plot was inspired by the true life story of François Picard, which Dumas found in Jacques Pouchet's Police Dévoilée, Mémoire historique tirée des Archives de Paris, 1838, a collection of anecdotes from the Parisian police archives. Briefly, the story is this. Picard, a young man from the south of France, was imprisoned in 1807, having been denounced by a group of friends as an English spy. Shortly after, he had become engaged to a young woman called Marguerite. The denunciation was inspired by a cafe owner, Mathieu Lupin, who was jealous of Picard's relationship with Marguerite. Picard was eventually moved to a form of house arrest in Piedmont and shut up in the castle of Finestrelle, where he acted as a servant to the rich Italian cleric. When the man died, abandoned by his family, he left money to Picard, whom he had come to treat as a son, also informing him the whereabouts of a hidden treasure. With the fall of Napoleon in 1814, Picard, now called Joseph Luchet, was released. In the following year, after collecting the hidden treasure, he returned to Paris. Here, he discovered that Marguerite had married Lupin, disguising himself and offering a valuable diamond to Alut, the one man in the group who had been unwilling to collaborate in the denunciation. He learned the identity of his enemies. He set about eliminating them, stabbing the first with a dagger on which were printed the words "Number One," and burning down Lupin's cafe. He managed to find employment in Lupin's house, disguised as a servant called Prosper. However, while this was going on, a lute had fallen out with the merchant to whom he had resold the diamond, had murdered him, and had been imprisoned. On coming out of jail, he started to blackmail Picard. Picard poisoned another of the conspirators, lured Lupin's son into crime and his daughter into prostitution, then finally stabbed Lupin himself. But he quarreled with Alut over the blackmail payments, and Alut killed him, confessing the whole story on his deathbed in 1828. It is obvious how directly Dumas was inspired by Pouchot's account of this extraordinary tale and how radically he transformed it. Incidentally, he used another chapter of the book as the basis for his story, for the story of Madame de Villefort. One important step in the transformation from true crime to fiction was to shift the opening of the tale from Paris to Marseille, giving the novel its Mediterranean dimension. Though most of the action still takes place in Paris, apart from a few excursions elsewhere, all the novel between chapters 39 and, I cannot read this, most of the novel is set in Paris. The sea is always present as a figure for escape and freedom, while the novel uses the southern origins of its characters as a mean to evoke that exotic world of the Mediterranean that had so fascinated French writers and artists since the 1820s. The Mediterranean is the point where the cultures of Europe meet those of the Orient, and the region had been in the forefront of people's minds since the 1820s because of the Greek struggle for independence and the French conquest of Algeria. Both of these are directly present in the novel. One of its young characters is a soldier who had just returned from Algeria. Another sets off to fight in the colony. As for Greece, which rebelled against the Turks in the 1820s, it inspired much fervor among the European romantics, most famously Lord Byron. The story of Ali, 1741 to 1822, Pasha in Albania, plays a direct part in the novel and also takes us into the Oriental world that fascinated the French romantics. The Orient, Victor Hugo wrote in the preface to his early collections of poems, Les Orientales, in 1829, both as an image and as an idea, has become sort of a general preoccupation for people's minds, as much as for their imaginations, to which the author has perhaps unwittingly succumbed. As of its own accord, the Oriental colors have come to stamp their mark on all his thoughts and reveries, and so they mark the paintings of Ingres and Delacroix. When we meet Heidi, she is lying on a heap of cushions, wearing her native Albanian costume, smoking a hookah, and framed in a doorway, like a charming painting. Italy was another Mediterranean land that held a powerful appeal for the Romantics, and in particular for Dumas. All the components of this appeal are in the novel: the classical world, the night vision, the night visit to the Colosseum, the excitement of travel, the cruel justice of the Papal States, the colorful spectacle, the Christian past, from the catacombs of St. Sebastian. The story of Luigi Vampa could have come directly from one of Stendhal's Italian Chronicles, the description of the Colosseum at night from one of Byron's or Shelley's letters. There's also a good deal of wit and the fruit of personal experience in Dumas's portrayal of the modern Romans and the day-to-day experiences of the Grand Tour. Like all the most skilled popular writers, he offers readers a mixture of the unfamiliar and expected, references to places, people, and events that will conjure up a whole complex of images and ideas. We have here the notion of Italy as it was perceived in France in the 1840s. Through literature and art, combined with those intimate touches that allow readers to experience the sensations of being there. Reading Dumas, we know how it felt to be swept up in the crowd at the carnival, to travel in a carriage through the Roman streets, to stay in a pension. We can easily recognize the proud bandit, the bustling hotelier, the alluring woman in the carnival crowd. All of these are described with as much economy as possible in order to avoid holding up the narrative. This is one reason why the popular novel tends to reinforce rather than to challenge prejudices, although in one case, Dumas's novel reversed a prejudice, namely that Marseille was, in the words of Murray's Handbook for Travelers in France, 1847, a busy and flourishing city, but one that has few public buildings or sites for strangers. The Count of Monte Cristo, on the contrary, with its intimate topography of the area around the Old Port and its dramatization of Marseille as the focus of mercantile activity, the meeting place of the Mediterranean cultures and the gateway to the Arab Maghreb, is a good deal more flattering than Murray's handbook. Dumas was allegedly thanked by a Marseille cab driver for promoting the city. Apart from this novel's depiction of France's major seaport, however, Dumas offers its readers a Rome and an Orient that are very much what they would expect. The first colorful, tuneful, proud and cruel, the second decadent and opulent. But he adds those little details that compel belief in what he is describing, the precise information about carnival etiquette, the street-by-street itinerary of a drive around the walls of Rome, the horrifying description of a Roman execution, sketches of character or scenery that he has culled from his own memories of staying in Signor Pastrini's hotel when he visited Rome in 1835. His passages on sailing ships spare us none of the technicalities of sails and mast. His descriptions of the effects of opium convince us that he has experienced them. And in much the same way, he adds touches of eruditism, a quotation from Horace, a reference to Hamlet, all of which are meant to reassure us that we are in reliable hands. At times, he even allows himself the luxury of a longer purple passage, perhaps a sunset over the Mediterranean, to show that he can do that too. All of this helps to justify his claim that he has transformed Pouchet's material into something infinitely more valuable. Pouchet's account of the Picard case, he wrote, was simply ridiculous, but inside this oyster there was a pearl, a rough, shapeless pearl of no value, waiting for its jeweler. And of course, the essential transformation that the jeweler makes to Pouchet's story lies in the character of the Count. To begin with, we have Edmond Dantès, the man who could well be a first cousin to the shoemaker, François Picard, betrayed by a jealous rival and ambitious colleague, sent to the fortress prison of If by a magistrate who cannot afford to let the facts come about, Dantès goes through a kind of burial and resurrection. Educated by Abbé Faria and a possessor of a limitless fortune, he can reemerge into the world, not as the cobbler Picard, content to stab or poison those responsible for his misfortune, but as an instrument of divine justice. Dumas's first vital departure from Pouchot is to make Monte Cristo only indirectly the avenger. His victims are all, in reality, destroyed by their own past misdeeds, which Monte Cristo uncovers. As the man who brings the truth to light and uses the discovery to punish the wrongdoer, Monte Cristo is a forerunner of the detective, the central figure in modern popular fiction. In fact, there is more than one reference to deductive methods that resemble those pioneered by Edgar Allan Poe, a manuscript found in a bottle, the gold bug, the murders in the Rue Morgue, for example, in the way in which Abbé Faria deciphers the will, showing where the treasure was hidden, Dantès's own analysis of where exactly it is concealed on the island, and earlier, Faria's explanation of Dantès's imprisonment. Note that, like the intellectual exercises of Monte Cristo's opium-taking successor later in the century, Sherlock Holmes, these deductions at first amaze those who have not been able to follow the logic behind them, or who do not have the experience to know, for example, when something has been written with the left hand by a right-handed person. But of course, Faria is not really a detective. The stereotype in Dumas's mind is that in the 18th century philosophy, a believer in the power of reason and a student of human nature. What Faria lacks, ironically, since everyone around him thinks him mad, insanely obsessed with this fictitious treasure, is the Holmesian neuroses, the brooding violin and the opium stupor. These come from a different fictional archetype. So does Monte Cristo. even though he is not averse at times to applying Faria's deductive logic and shares Holmes's talent for disguise. Having emerged in 1829 from his entombment, found his treasure, discovered the fate of his father and of Mercedes, and repaid his debt to Morel, Dantes then disappears for another 9 years, about which the reader is told virtually nothing. The second period of latency is not strictly a remarking, but an effacement. The character who reemerges in the novel as the Count of Monte Cristo is shrouded in mystery. We only assume at first that he is identical to Edmond Dantes on the slender evidence of them using the same pseudonym, Sinbad the Sailor. He is a dark, brooding figure, pale-faced, with an aversion to food and apparently devoid of some human feelings. He takes an evil delight in terrifying his young friends, Albert and Franz, with the spectacle of an execution. He is also, as they learn later, on good terms with the bandit Luigi Vampa. The appearance of this deathly white apparition in a box at the Roman Opera immediately evokes two other personalities who played a major role in popular mythology in France in the Romantic era. The first is Lord Byron, a real-life character who very early was confused with his fictional creations, Childe Harold, Manfred, and Don Juan, all the more so in France, where the poetry might be known only in translation. The image was that of a young but world-weary hero, tormented by nameless despairs. The second figure was that of a vampire, associated with the first through the story of Lord Ruthwen, or the vampire, which was attributed to Byron, though in fact written by his competitor. This was not by any means the only vampire to be found in France at the time. The theater, notably during the 1820s, was haunted by the undead, English vampires, comic vampires, female vampires. The nature of the vampire was perhaps not so precisely codified as it was to be later, especially by Bram Stokes in that tale of another mysterious count, Garlic, Stakes, and Crosses. Transylvania, the vampire's native soil in the coffin, which he keeps in the basement, these are not yet firmly established in the mythology, but the figure is there, and the elements of the legend specifically ascribed to the Byronic figure of Monte Cristo. What I would like to suggest is that Dumas's novel stands at a crucial point in the development of modern popular fiction, drawing into the genre elements from romantic literature, popular theater, history, and actuality, and wrapping them in a narrative carefully enough to be constructed and dramatic enough to hold the attention of a growing reading public with a great appetite for fiction. They would satisfy it not only with books, but also with newspaper serials, which had brought fame and fortune to Dumas's persecutor in the genre, Eugène Sue. Monte Cristo owes its existence directly to Sue's Mystère de Paris, 1842 to 1843. It was precisely the success of Sue's tales that made Dumas's publishers demand a novel rather than the historical guide to Paris that they had originally commissioned. Sue's appeal to the public was the ability to suggest the existence of the sinister underworld of crime and intrigue behind the facade of Paris that was familiar to most of its readers. The growth of the 19th century metropolis led to a whole literature of urban life, later exploited on film, in which the city was no longer seen as a place of civilized urbane living and safety from attack, but as a menacing subworld, in which human beings prey on one another and suffer fearful bouts of loneliness, alienation, and ennui. A machine devised to supply every need of civilized humanity in one place has become a monster, enclosing every form of vice and depravity. Only in England did murder continue to take place in country houses. As noted earlier, Paris is the setting for the greater part of the book, but the episodes in Marseille and Rome enrich it enormously. We do have, at the very center, a very Parisian murder story, joined to a rather trite Parisian romance, and Dumas locates every event precisely on the city map so that all the addresses are real. But the overall impression left by the novel is something far larger in scope than the tale of Parisian wrongdoing and revenge. The episodes in Marseille and Rome may have been added after the book was begun. It was Dumas's collaborator, Maquette, who suggested actually recounting Dante's arrest and imprisonment. Instead of starting the novel in Rome and then transferring the action rapidly to Paris, yet the first section proves absolutely crucial, where the Count, in himself, descends at times to this level of a melodramatic stage avenger. Dante is a compelling character, and it is the figure of Edmond Dantès, whom we feel obscurely present in his later incarnation, which gives the latter depth and weight. The reemergence of other characters after the latency period of Dante's imprisonment is more of a problem. Caderousse is essentially unchanged. D'Anglès, more or less unrecognizable. Ferdinand offers the least plausible transformation of all, from the brave and honest Spaniard with a sharp sense of honor, whom we meet in the early chapters, to the Parisian aristocrat whose life seems to have been dedicated to a series of betrayals. Ferdinand seems to confirm a criticism of Dumas and of popular novels in general, namely that they tend to sacrifice character to plot. In some respects, though, in Dumas's novel, the reverse is true. Dumas's novel is dictated by character, but it is character viewed more as an imaginative construct than as a philosophical novelist would conceive it. The Count himself is a poetic character, a creature of the imagination, who draws on elements from myth as much as from the everyday psychological observation. And while Madame de Villefort, Valentine, Morel, and some others in Dumas's huge cast may be flat characters, performing a largely functional role in the development of the story, there are several secondary figures to whom this does not apply, notably Eugénie d'Anglès and Albert de Morcerf. In many ways, Eugénie is Valentine's twin. Both women are heiresses to large fortunes. Both are presented with the alternatives of subjecting themselves to their father's will and marrying men whom they do not love or being confined to a convent. But where Valentine is willing to submit, Eugénie is not. Her lesbianism may be a trait of personality, but is also an expression of her desire for independence. There is far more to The Count of Monte Cristo than merely a tale of adventure and revenge. Nonetheless, it is a book that many people first encounter and enjoy during their teens. Not long after Dumas's death, Victor Hugo wrote a letter to his friend's son, Alector Dumas's fils, in which he praised Dumas as a writer of universal appeal and added, he creates a thirst for reading. After more than 150 years, The Count of Monte Cristo remains one of the most popular and widely read novels in the world of literature. Its longevity singles it out as almost unique among popular novels. For many of its readers, despite its length, it seems all too short. We want to spend more time with the Count and the other characters in the book, more time in its bustling world of drama and passion. Creating the thirst for more is among Dumas's great contributions to literature. A note on the text. The Count of Monte Cristo began publication in parts in the Journal des Débats in August 1844. This continued until January 1846, by which time the first 18-volume edition had been published by Pietin, 1845 to 1846. The second, third, and fourth editions appeared in 1846, and there were several pirate editions in the 1840s. The book continued to be republished throughout the century, the last edition in Dumas's lifetime being that published by Michael Levy in 1865. The novel was rapidly translated into English in England in Ainsworth Magazine, 1845, and by Emma Hardy, 1846, and in America in 1846, and into Danish, 1845, 1846, Swedish, 1846, Italian, 1847, Spanish, 1858, Norwegian, 1881 to 1882, and German, 1902. The first stage adaptation was the one made by Dumas and Maquette themselves in 1848 in two parts, in 1851 in two parts, finally shown in one single performance of five acts and 12 tableaux in 1862. Long before this, however, there had been a stage parody by Deforge and Clervy, Le Comte de Monte Fiasco, 1847, a further tribute to the notoriety of the work. The most recent stage version was a new adaptation performed in England in 1994. There have been condensed editions, children's edition, and a comic book version. There were film adaptations, 1908, USA, 1913, USA, 1914, France, 1934, USA, 1942, France, 1953, France, 1961, France, 1975, USA, and 2001, USA, as well as television versions. The strength of the story is enough to explain why the novel has proved so adaptable to other media, despite its length. The central themes of betrayal, wrongful imprisonment, and revenge are clear enough to allow many of the subplots to be discarded for reasons of time or space. Inevitably, something will be lost. There's simply so much there. And from the earliest days, the process undergone by Dumas's novel was one of reduction, as if the original was too vast to stand by itself. There is also the matter of the historical moment at which the Count of Monte Cristo appeared. The mid-19th century saw a continuing struggle to establish the credentials of the literary world, the literary novel, by giving it the dual aims that Stendhal had helped to pioneer, which were those of exploring the enduring features of human psychology and analyzing a particular state of human society. In contrast to such enterprises, fiction, which involved larger-than-life characters and implausible situation, gothic horrors, melodramatic accidents, and so on, appeared mere entertainment. The gradual emergence of realism in the European novel was not altogether to the advantage of Dumas, whose image was less than that of austere. Priest was less that of the austere priest than the jolly friar, and whose novels poured out of a factory, the purpose of which was to create entertainment and sell it for money. This explains why, though Thackeray admitted finding the book impossible to put down, English novelists like George Eliot considered the French, Dumas, Hugo, and Balzac, were mistakenly tempted to deal with the exception rather than the rule, to look for the melodramatic situations and characters when they should be exploring everyday life that revealed what is enduring in human nature. It is not hard, anyway, to guess that the author of Middlemarch and The Mill on the Floss would not find much to please her in The Three Musketeers or The Count of Monte Cristo. There is also the question of Dumas's style, which is usually unremarkable, and the fact that he wrote the great novels in collaboration with Marquette, which does not accord with the idea of the author as sole creator. No wonder people have thought that they could treat The Count of Monte Cristo as a treasure trove rather than a sacred text, or that the many adaptations, abbreviations, and reworkings of it have been done with a good deal of less reverence and consequently, more often than not, a good deal more success than, say, Claude Chabrol brought to the film version of his Madame Bovary. In the main, its fate has been that of most 19th century adventure novels. It has been treated as mere entertainment for adults or literature for the young. The truth is that, more because of the subject matter than because of its length, the novel has had to be tampered with before it can be offered to young readers, or, as one may conjecture, to readers in mid-Victorian England. And because this is merely a popular novel, as well as one which represents a huge amount of work for a translator, there has been little enthusiasm in the English-speaking world for retranslating it. Claude Chappe's edition in 1993, which lists the foreign translations, records nothing into English since 1910. The most readily available edition in Britain at the moment reproduces the anonymous translation first published by Chapman and Hall in 1846. Its editor for the Oxford World Classics series, 1990, David Coward, writes that, with one or two exceptions, a small number of new translations since have drawn heavily upon the classic version. Anyone who has read The Count of Monte Cristo, only in this classic version, has never read Dumas's novel. For a start, the translation is occasionally inaccurate and is written in a 19th century English that now sounds far more antiquated than the French of the original does to a modern French reader. To mention one small point in this connection, Dumas uses a good deal of dialogue. He wrote by the line, and the constant inversions of said said he and cried he are both irritating and antiquated. There are some real oddities, like the attempt to convey popular speech, which does not correspond to anything in Dumas, when the sailor says, "That's one of them nabob gentlemen from Ingi, no doubt." Even aside from that, most of the dialogues in the 19th century translation, in which the characters utter sentences like, "I will join you ere long," "I confess, he asked me none," and "When will all this cease?" have the authentic creak of the Victorian stage boards and gas-like melodramas. It can be argued that this language accurately conveys an aspect of Dumas's work, but not even his worst detractors would pretend that there is nothing more to it than that. Still less acceptable, however, than the language of this Victorian translations is the huge number of omissions and balderizations of Dumas's texts. The latter include part of Franz's opium dream at the end of chapter 31, some of the dialogue between Villefort and Madame Danglars, and several parts of several chapters that cover Eugenie's and Louise's flight to Belgium. In some cases, the changes are so slight as to be quite hard to detect. In the descriptions of Eugenie at the opera, for example, Dumas remarks that if one could reproach her for anything, it was that both her upbringing and her appearance, she seemed rather to belong to another sex. The English translator renders this, as for her attainments, the only fault to be found with them was that they were somewhat too erudite and masculine for such a young person. And at the end of another chapter, page 950, the translation simply omits the few lines of dialogue where Dumas has Eugene say that "Laissera tes belles et bien consommées," where the word "rapt," abduction, has rather too overtly sexual connotation. Similarly, earlier in the chapter, where Eugenie jokes that anyone would think she was abducting Louise, another word used almost exclusively of a man with a woman, the translator prefers the more neutral phrase "carrying me off" and omits altogether Louise's mark to Eugenie's that Eugenie is a real Amazon. Another anonymous translator, Dent, 1894, refers to the escape rather than the abduction, which makes nonsense of Louise's reply that it is not a true abduction, since it had been accomplished without violence. What may be more surprising than these concessions to the prudery of the age is that the Victorian translators left in as much as they did, and the omissions are by no means all to do with sexual matters. At the start of one chapter, for example, the translator decides to spare us the description of the route taken through Rome by Albert and Franz on their way to the Colosseum, though the 1894 translator restores it. A whole paragraph analyzing the character of Monsieur de Villefort at the start of another chapter is cut out. Almost a whole page of dialogue between Albert and Monte Cristo on horses is cavalierly omitted. Part was restored by the translator in 1894, and so on. This is only a tiny sample of what, in reality, a vast number of phrases are omitted and occasionally mistranslated. What we see here, interestingly enough, is a stage in the process of transforming Dumas's text into something simpler, less complex, less rich in allusions, but more concentrated in plot and action. The 1846 translator already has an idea of what kind of novel this is, and that dictates what he or she can afford to omit. Travelogue, classical references, sexual and psychological analysis, and so on. None of these is essential to the plot of a thriller, and if some of them will embarrass English readers, then why not leave them out? The only problem is that nearly 150 years later, we do not have quite the same idea of what is and is not important. It was high time to get back to Dumas, entire and unexpurgated. As the basis for my translation, I've used the edition by Schoppe, quoted above, and the three-volume edition in the Livre de Poche, 1973. Both of these use an arrangement of chapters which differs slightly from the 19th-century translations. I have followed the Livre de Poche, not in changing Dumas's errors of chronology, etc., and the text as Schoppe has done. Instead, I have pointed out the more important ones in the notes. I owe a debt to Schoppe and to Coward's edition in the World Classic series for some of the information in the notes. On the broader question of translation, I have tried, above all, to produce a version that is accurate and readable. A great deal of nonsense is written about translation, particularly by the academics who approach it either as a terrain for theoretical debate or, worse still, as a moral issue. The translator must always be faithful to its original, Leonard Tancock wrote, oddly assuming that the translation is a masculine activity, even though on this occasion he was prefacing Nancy Mitford's translation of La Princesse de Clèves, Penguin, 1978, and has no right whatever to take the liberties with it. Nor has he any right to try and smooth the reader's path by the omission of dull bits, short-circuiting, explanatory additions, radical transformations, or changes of order. Why? And who says? Is it the reader who is demanding this perfection, this absence of explanatory additions, and so on? Such academic theorists insist that a translation must read like a translation. It is somehow immoral to conceal the process that has gone into making it. Ordinary readers usually demand the opposite, and reviewers in quite respectable papers sometimes show little appreciation of what the process means and involves. Not all of this material works in translation, said one serious review of a book by Umberto Eco, and another, The Stories of Victoria Tokareva, are well served by their translator, who hardly ever gets in the way. In philosophical terms, I'm quite willing to admit the impossibility of translation, while still having, in practical terms, to engage in it and to believe everything must, to some extent, be translatable. I feel no obligation to avoid smoothing over the reader's path, and on the other hand, to getting in the way from time to time. Above all, I want to convey some of the pleasure of reading Dumas to those who cannot do so in its original language, and through my one particular version, since no translation can ever be definitive, to reveal aspects of his work that are not to be found in any of the existing versions. This is a new translation, and consequently a new interpretation of a great and very popular novel. If nothing else, most people should surely agree that it's long overdue. We'll stop here for today's reading of The Count of Monte Cristo. I've read the chronology, their introduction, and a note on the text, and next will be the actual novel itself. It's translated by Robin Boos. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Larissa Biggers from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.